From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Has our understanding of autism evolved in the past decade? That will be the subject of the 10th annual conference called Promising Pathways at FGCU next month. It will look at how the scientific community has endeavored to unravel the mysteries of the autistic human mind and look at how public perception has created communities of support for families where autism is a part of daily life. Plus, ECHO's Global Garden will be open to the public next weekend for people to learn how seven different climates can affect the ability to grow sustainable crops. We'll learn about ECHO's effort to put a dent in world hunger by developing nutrient-dense foods that can grow in varying weather and climate conditions. First, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The word autism was first used at the beginning of the 20th century, and much later, in 1944, German scientist Hans Asperger sought to more clearly define milder forms of autism. But it wasn't until the 1980s that autism research gained momentum, and it started to be recognized by society at large. But what has been gleaned in the decades since the 80s? Next month will mark the 10-year anniversary of the Promising Pathways Conference on Autism at FGCU. And joining me to talk about the event and look back at the last decade of the research and advancement is Leanne Nowak with FGCU's Center for Autism. Thank you for joining us, Leanne.
Happy to be here.
Also here is a past presenter who will also be at this year's conference. We are hoping to be joined on the phone by Dr. Richard Grinker. He is a professor of anthropology at George Washington University. He'll be with us shortly. Also, we have Brad Karpel. He's an autistic FGCU student and a past presenter at the Promising Pathways event. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And also Brad's uncle Stan is with us. Thank you for coming in, Stan.
Appreciate it.
We are talking about the upcoming Promising Pathways Conference on Autism, which will take a quick look at back at the past decade while also looking to the future goals of understanding autism. You can share your thoughts with us today at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And on Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Leanna Nowak, organizing this event for the 10th year, what are some of the biggest changes that you can think of that have happened in the world of autism since this conference began?
Well, one of the reasons why we're doing this 10th anniversary program and bringing back our past keynote speakers is so that we can find out more about what has happened in the research field in the last 10 years, because many of the keynote people that we've had in the past are researchers.
And they're some of the pioneers in the research field.
Yes, yes. But I do have some things that I am aware of. One of the things that just came out across my desk is from the MISSING program, and it's M-S-S-N-G. And that is a collaboration between Autism Speaks and Google Life Sciences. And they have a database of over 7,000 sets of DNA. And what they just recently found out is that there are 18 new autism-linked genes. And so 80% of the 61 gene variations that they've discovered so far affect biochemical pathways that have clear potential as targets for future medicines. And that's something that we have not been able to get to.
So they're identifying genetic markers that are they're genes that can be impacted by medical intervention?
Yes. Well, that's what they're hoping.
They're hoping.
That's what the goal is.
Wow.
Because we still don't know what causes autism spectrum disorder. But with the genetic research that's going on, they're finding out that there are not just one gene that's affected by that people with autism have, but there are multiple genes. So there's these 61 gene patterns. And what then they're thinking is that they can then decide what type of autism a person might have. So with one genetic set of differences, a person with autism spectrum disorder might also be predisposed to have seizures. Another type might be predisposed for cardiac defects, and another yet for, say, adult diabetes. And so when you're able to link the genes to additional diagnoses, it's going to be a more personalized approach to helping that individual who has an autism spectrum disorder.
So one of the things I just picked up that you just mentioned is there are a lot of different types of expression of autism in different people. Did we know all these different kinds or different levels and different, you know, I guess I want to say shades of autism way back 10 years ago?
Oh, yes.
We knew that.
We knew that.
We knew there were certain people
and
that
that's why it's called a spectrum.
Okay.
Because there are individuals on one end of the spectrum who may be nonverbal, have difficulty understanding communication, have challenging behavior that really interferes with their activities of daily living. And then you have individuals on the other side of the spectrum who are very verbal, very intelligent, don't have any kind of intellectual disability, and are able to go to college, get married, have children. So it's a very wide range of individuals who are diagnosed with the same diagnoses, autism spectrum disorder.
And Brad, I feel like we're sitting here talking about you and you're right here in the room. So you're a student at FGCU.
Yes.
And tell me a little bit about your story. How did you end up coming to FGCU and what's been your trajectory?
Well, I just decided that I wanted to continue my education. I work at in Naples at a community health center in the medical records department. I just also wanted to get the college experience because I never really felt that I actually got the college experience because the last time I went to college, I was more focused on just getting my work done and my schooling, and so I just wanted to experience, you know, go to clubs and join organizations and just experience that while also advancing my career.
So you're going forward with your scholastic part, but you're also getting more involved in the social side of things.
Yes.
So it's been, you know, how old are you?
30.
Okay. Sorry, I don't mean to intrude, but so you've been living with autism for a while. So like how would you say, do you think things kind of sped up as far as people's understanding of autism in the last 10 years or 15 years or so?
Give me a minute.
Because, you know, it seems like there's been so much research and there's a lot of stuff going on. Do you think that people's understanding of autism has evolved and changed?
Yeah, I think it's kind of evolved and changed over time. I think people have become more accepting because it's actually been in their faces more. They've seen it because of more inclusion and there's been more visibility in the community, so people actually have to take the time to understand it rather than it being hidden everywhere.
And what are you studying?
Community health.
Community health. And your goal is to be involved in programming, you said?
No. I would like to medical code for the company I work for, but I'd like to stay at my company for a while. Beyond that, I'm not sure of my goals yet, but I just would like to have the career to make myself more marketable.
Yeah. Well, it's also good to focus on the social part too.
Yes.
That's what college is not all about, but that's a big part of it.
Right.
So that's great. And Stan, you're Brad's uncle, and I understand that you have a son that has autism as well?
Yes.
Okay. Where on the spectrum does he fit?
He's an Aspie like Brad.
Oh, okay, so Aspie means that's kind of shorthand for Asperger.
That's what he calls himself, an Aspie.
An Aspie.
It's a term that
I won't tell you what I call him. It's not good for public.
Like the great Aspie, right?
It's a term that usually people with Asperger's use for ourselves.
It's kind of like a
ourselves
shorthand.
Aspies, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's so. How is
and
your
an
son?
Aspie will call us a neurotypical.
A neurotypical.
We call you NT.
NT. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know I was ever.
You have to learn the language first.
Well, this is a great lesson for me and everybody else that's listening. An NT, a neuro what?
Typical.
Typical. Neurotypical. With no memory, apparently. You just said it 5 seconds ago and I can't remember. So how old is your son?
37.
Okay, so now you've seen how things have changed over the years.
If I may.
Yes?
I can talk a lot more into the past than somewhat the present because he doesn't live with us anymore, with me anymore. Mm-hmm. He's married. Has a college degree in programming. He's bluntly, and I've been dealing, I'm not a programmer, but I've been dealing with, when I worked with programs, et cetera, for years. He's the best software applicator. Give him a job. Software applicator, I know. He's that good.
Yeah.
But the autism is a problem for him.
How does it present as a problem?
Well, I'm going to take you to the past. He had, when he was in high school, he had scholarship offers to the Gazookas, but he couldn't use any of them except for the one locally because the schools were not prepared for someone. He needed a safety net, and they were not prepared for it.
So this was, what, 17 years ago or?
90s.
In the 90s.
Into the early part of the O's.
Okay. So, Leanna, are things different now? Are schools more capable of bringing in students that have ASBs, if you will?
It's beginning to change. There are several programs within the state of Florida and throughout the United States that do have programs specifically for individuals who have autism spectrum disorder and some with additional diagnoses as well that kind of help with those soft skills. So typically, it isn't the academics that are difficult for these individuals. It's the social skills and communication skills.
That's true.
And so that's where some of these extra college programs are coming in. Most of them are separate from the college itself, but some of them are within the college.
Mm-hmm. If I may, my family's joke about our son, and I mean the extended family, is that if he could speak English, he would have been the next Bill Gates.
Oh.
But
he's not incredibly verbal.
The social stuff kills him.
Yeah, the social stuff is what's tough for him.
It's very difficult.
Tough to overcome. And is that something, and I'm not really that familiar, is it something that can be learned over time or habituated to, or is it just there's
– You
answer that, Brad.
You have to work on it a lot. You have to put a lot of hours into it. I go to speech therapy religiously every week. I see a psychologist that helps me. So it can learn, but you have to put a lot of time and effort into it.
It's very difficult. You have to overcome your natural instincts.
And your natural instinct would be to shut down and just...
Yes.
Well, you're a puppy swimming in an ocean full of NT sharks, there's zillions of them. That's tough.
So you just your natural inclination would be just shut down and just be quiet and not assert yourself?
Yes and no. You have to kind of change how you approach things and change your thought patterns, which I learned to do over time.
Yeah, and coping mechanisms are something that do take a lot of energy.
Yes,
it takes a lot of time and energy.
Right now, my schedule is very, very full. I have a lot of things going on, so one of the things I need to get through the week is I need at least a day or two to myself to recharge from the mentally draining week. So that's one coping mechanism that I utilize.
Mm-hmm. Do you have – I mean, I'm just going to ask you, do you have any tips for people that come into contact? Like, you know, give me a break and back off with the questions. Of course, we're in an interview situation here. But, I mean, how when people are interacting, what kind of things would you like to just tell everybody at the outset?
Can you be a bit more specific?
You know, for example, like, could you speak more slowly, speak more clearly, be more specific with your questions, things like that?
Being more specific would help a lot. That's one tip I would give to people interacting with people on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. All right.
If I might add a little bit to that, Brad does an excellent job at talking about what his experience is. Another thing that we see and hear in the field is that being a person who has an autism spectrum disorder, it's a brain disability with certain parts of the brain being affected. And a lot of those parts are, like we talked about, the social skills and the communication skills. And sometimes people liken a person who has an autism spectrum disorder themselves when they're trying to interact with neurotypicals that it's like being in a foreign country and not understanding the language.
Different English. NT English versus ASPE English. Different English.
Just different ways of expressing oneself.
Yes.
We are talking about the Promising Pathways Conference on Autism with our guests, organizer Leanna Nowak with FGCU's Center for Autism. We're also talking with Brad Karpel, an FGCU student who presented at Promising Pathways before. And we're also talking with his uncle Stan, who also has a son with Asperger's. You can become part of the conversation by giving us a call at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or you can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. And we were talking with we were planning on talking with Dr. Grinker, and he wrote a book that talked about how different cultures handled or dealt with Asperger's or autism disorder. And he brought in a lot of information as an anthropologist. Can you tell me a little bit about the speech that he gave? You mentioned, Leanna, that it was pretty riveting for people when he was here last time, and he's coming back again this year.
He's studied autism in many different countries. Probably the most the country that he's studied the most in has been in Korea. And he just has traveled as part of his anthropology work to discover how individuals are treated, what are the therapies, and how that is different from the United States. And so for many people who were in that audience that day, it was really kind of eye-opening to find out where autism spectrum disorder is in terms of other countries and how people are perceived and what are some of the treatments and whether they're specialized schools or general public schools. So it was just really fascinating to find out
I think it's other cultures. It's so interesting to hear how other cultures handle everything, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. Especially something like this. Were there any standout differences that you can remember from that? I don't want to put you on the spot, but I know that he was going to join us on the phone and we didn't get to get him. But I just
am I allowed to ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Was Korea the place where they identified a much greater percentage of the populace being on the spectrum?
At that time, he said that there, in general, the amount of individuals who have an autism spectrum disorder in any group is about 1 to 2%. Now, here in the United States, one of the studies that occurred several years ago was with the Somali population that had emigrated to Minnesota. And what they were seeing in that population was a higher percentage of individuals mm-hmm. with autism spectrum disorder.
Okay. And speaking of diagnosis and numbers, you know, when I was growing up in the 70s, you didn't hear anything about anybody having autism. Some people feel that, you know, there's an epidemic. We have a whole lot of autism going on. Is that true or are we just diagnosing it more?
I honestly believe that we have better diagnostic tools now than we did before. I really don't think it's an epidemic.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel the same way, Leanna?
Well, for a while, it was a big disparity every time they did a prevalence rating. So I forget the year that they began doing it, but it was like 1 in 25,000 births, and then it was 1 in 5,000, and then 1 in 2,000. And in the year 2000, it was 1 in 150, and currently it's 1 in 168. And I think Brad's right. We do have much better identification tools, diagnostic tools, and we have a lot of celebrities in the community and a lot of sports figures who have children who have autism spectrum disorder. And when we see that and talk about it and it's out in the media, people are more likely to say, oh, I might recognize that in my child. The other reason there could be a greater prevalence rate is in both the medical field and in the early childhood field, there were specific campaigns to identify children, not specifically with autism spectrum disorder, but those that weren't meeting milestones. And that's often how young children get into the system to be identified with autism spectrum disorders is that language delay. Because that's one of the biggest characteristics is difficulty with communication.
Mm-hmm. And Stan, I wanted to ask you, 37 years ago, you said your son's 37, so, well, I guess it would be 34, 35 years ago when you started learning what was going on with your son. How hard was it to have him diagnosed back then?
Okay. First of all, my wife and I diagnosed it. We're both probably overly educated, I had been a teacher in New York at that time, right before we moved out and then he was born. So we are the ones who pushed him into seeing a psychologist when he was about 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
The best in the county we lived in at mm-hmm. that time. The problem was that autism wasn't fully understood. And this guy was excellent, seriously. It really wasn't full, except for the what you'd see in movies and maybe in a book or something, reading a book. I remember one descriptor of him was that, my son, was that he was autistic-like tendencies, but had a form of attention deficit, but not the guy on the ceiling, the guy who would sort of hide inside himself.
Mm-hmm. Not the guy bouncing off the walls,
buried inside himself.
Yeah.
So we knew he needed help. Yeah, we wanted the great next third baseman, PhD, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then, you got to face the reality.
What kind of support did you find when this happened? I mean, this was a while back. This is before the 80s.
Support was limited. Support was limited. Today, you have, well, I don't know about today, but a few years back, you started seeing schools that were dedicated to autistic students. You get thrown into a special ed program with other special ed kids in a mix and with major differences. So support very limited. Not counting family. Family was great.
Well, yeah, but you mentioned that the intellectual aspect is not the problem at all. They're pretty bright.
It depends.
It depends on the person, but your son was pretty bright.
I don't have any stats. Yeah. And I'm an old stats guy, but I don't have any stats on this. But I would think the difference statistically in terms of who would have not IQ testing, because Aspie's, I don't believe, do well in those type of standardized tests. They're part of the tail that doesn't work, mm-hmm. I think. That's my gut. But intellectually, at least in my son and that thug in the corner, Brad, they're smart, but they're wired differently. But they're brilliant.
And I think that's one of the changes, too, is that they're wired differently, meaning that years ago, there was a standard way of teaching every student.
They would just all get kind of lumped together.
And we didn't regardless. Know that because a person's brain worked differently, there were different ways to teach them. And now people or educators are better able to understand that and better able to apply different methods of teaching that are conducive to this type of brain.
And now the early education is a little bit more on target for these – for these guys. So like, for example, your son would have missed out on early education. I mean, you're a teacher, so maybe not so much. But I mean, as a person who's a teacher, knowing how important early education is for kids, it's got to be tough when it's not there for your child's specific needs.
If I make one little correction, I haven't been a teacher in a zillion years. But
I you were a teacher right before then. Yeah.
At that time, I had just been. You're absolutely right. He had an advantage. He had a champion mom. You talk about the grizzly moms or something.
Yeah.
He had a champion mom who didn't take crap from anybody. When it came to Eric, our son, he had an educated and she had a master's. I had a master's. Mine was in education, special ed, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was obvious. You had to be blind. We also got into wars with schools.
Yeah, I bet. I bet you had to be kind of a warrior.
More
really.
Hard than me, but yeah.
Yeah.
I could be the wuss sitting in the corner, you know,
just
watching the action.
Pointing to your wife, like just what she said.
Who's going to beat up a 5'90" pounder?
So I wanted to get back to Brad. Tell me about the Promising Pathways event that you did before. You got up and spoke in front of everybody at this conference before. What did you talk about at that?
I've talked at a couple of them. I've talked about relationship skills. I've talked about employment skills. And I've talked about tips and strategies on getting around rigid thinking and emotional control.
Wow, that's quite a bit to tackle. And you did this in front of a crowd of people.
Yeah. I've spoken at three different conferences.
That's quite an accomplishment for anyone, anyway.
Brad attracts our audience of individuals who have autism spectrum disorder who are looking for learning those kinds of skills. And he also attracts educators and professionals because they want to learn more in terms of what they can do to help the individuals who have autism spectrum
And learn the
disorder.
Language, right? Like you were saying, it's a different mm-hmm. language. And so the people that have Aspie would understand the language you're speaking
right.
because you're communicating in the way that you would want to be communicated with as well.
Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, Brad would not be sitting here. He couldn't do it. There's no doubt in my mind he could not do it.
Yeah, but I mean, like you said, you've been working really hard.
He had to work at it. It's hard.
And Leanna, what other speakers this year can people expect to hear from?
We have Dr. Mohammad Ghazuddin, who was a very popular speaker. He's a psychiatrist and talked about different medications. There's not a medication for autism itself, but for co-occurring conditions or other symptoms. We have Dr. Richard Grinker, as we said. We have Dr. Diane Treadwell Deering, who is also a psychiatrist. We have Dr. Beth Sulzer-Ozeroff, and she is a woman who lives locally and is very well known in the field of behavior analysts. And we have Dr. Robert Hendren and Dr. Peter Mundy.
And I've just been told that we have Dr. Grinker on the phone. Dr. Grinker, we're so glad you're here to join us.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
So we've been talking for a while about Asperger's and autism disorder, and one of the things that we mentioned earlier was about your work in different cultures. And as a professor of anthropology, you've written about history and culture in Africa, Korea, and then you have a publication entitled Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism. How did you end up coming to study autism?
Well, like many people who study autism, I have a personal connection. My daughter was 25 now, was diagnosed with autism when she was a little more than 2 years old, and lots of people said to me, well, you're a dad of someone with autism, and you're an anthropologist. You must know everything about autism across the world. What do they do about it in Bolivia? What's the prevalence of autism in New Zealand, and so on? And I thought, well, I don't know any of this stuff, but somebody must. And I started to do library research and realized that we know very little about autism anywhere except for Northern Europe and North America. And that's really what pushed me to start to travel and start not only to think about autism in other parts of the world, but also how looking at it in other parts of the world can change the way we look at our own world.
What stood out to you from other cultures as far as how parents and societies looked at autism?
One of the things that stood out to me was that even in societies that had a concept that is analogous to our concept of autism, didn't have the same cluster of symptoms associated with it. And so they didn't really share the same pattern of symptoms. Now, it's not that those symptoms didn't exist, but in their concept of what autism was, it didn't include the same categories. So, for example, poor eye gaze or sensory hypersensitivities, things of that sort were not included. Even repetitive behaviors were not thought of as associated with autism in some parts of the world, like in India and in Southern Africa. And that's not unlike lots and lots of other conditions that we know about, whether it's post-traumatic stress disorder or attention deficit disorder or schizophrenia or anything like that. Not every place in the world sees these things as having the same assemblage of features.
So what we were talking about earlier, we were talking a lot about how things have changed in just the last decade or two as far as public perception and a societal shift in dealing with autism. Can you tell me a little bit about what that says about greater shifts in society as far as the rise of advocacy and the rise in acceptance of psychology in general?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that have been dramatic changes and over the last couple of decades, and I think that they've both actually been very helpful for neurodiversity, as it's sometimes called. One of those is the shift away from seeing autism as something caused by parents in the old days, and actually today, in some parts of the world, autism is seen to be caused by bad parenting. And we know that that is absolutely not the case. The second thing that has shifted, as the concept of autism has become more broad, is an appreciation that autism is not just about deficit, but autism is also about skills and abilities and uniqueness. And much of what constitutes autism may be the same foundation that gives us our creativity and our difference as human beings.
And another thing I wanted
to... I think that's had a great effect.
Yeah, and I wanted to give you a chance to address another topic that comes up almost all the time, but it's something that rose in popularity as a perception of autism and then was debunked, is the idea of vaccines having anything to do with autism. You said that it had been blamed on parents and then it was blamed on vaccines. Can you tell me a little bit about that arc?
Yeah. Well, sure, ever since the first vaccine was ever introduced in the United States, the smallpox vaccine in the end of the 1700s, there have been anti-vaccine movements. There have been anti-vaccine movements all over the world. And those the anti-vaccine movements are often associated with a fear of government and a fear of government entering into the family. So having anti-vaccine movements is not new. What happened here was that as the concept of autism grew in popularity and as the spectrum of autism became defined, there was this coincidence of time that autism has its symptoms really emerge and is diagnosable at the age when children are getting vaccines. And because of this kind of synchronicity, there were people, conspiracy theorists, who developed this idea that vaccines were not only associated with autism, but changes in autism prevalence. And we know from so many studies that this is not the case. And I have continually been impressed by how science responded to that conspiracy theory very quickly and very rigorously to debunk this. And a lot of it also came from a case of fraud in England by Andrew Wakefield.
And another thing that we talked about a little bit is the increase in diagnoses of autism. And something that you put in your book is that it's not because there's more autism. It's because there is more accurate diagnosis. There is more more readily identified, and the scientific community understands it better. And so, therefore, we are now able to quantify it with some numbers. So do you think
Let me give you on that. I'm going to interrupt because I just want to – I'm not sure what question you're asking, but But I've got a statistic that I'd like to give you.
Okay.
And it is that in the past decade, the proportion of children in the United States that receive special education services has remained static or has fallen slightly. So no change over the past 10, even 15 years, really, in the percentage of children who are receiving special education in our public schools. But autism has increased as a classification by 300%. So how in the United States do you have the same number of kids, or same percentage, rather, proportion of kids getting special education services as 15 years ago, but a 300% rise in classifications of autism, only because other classifications drop off?
And they were categorized differently.
Yes, absolutely, particularly the decline in learning, specific learning disability, and also intellectual disability.
Mm-hmm. And the categorization is what kind of explains that the static level of kids in special education up against the increase in autistic diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many factors. There are many factors that go into it, whether it's a school system that might have incentives because you get more money for autism classifications. But the thing is that most autism classifications don't occur because some doctor out there is being faithful to some set of rules or criteria, but rather that a school is trying to figure out how to best educate a child. And often the autism programs are best for a child who might not qualify for a scientific study of autism as autistic, yet we know that that's the best placement for them. In fact, in my book, On Strange Minds, I have a quote from the head of child psychiatry at the National Institute of Mental Health, who says, in my research, I'll be rigorous in making sure that if I'm studying autism, those kids are, you know, fitting those criteria. But in my clinical practice, I'll call a kid a zebra if it gets him the educational service that I think he'll benefit most from.
Well, I have to cut it off now because we've kind of run out of time, but I'm glad you got a chance to join us, Dr. Grinker. It has been great to talk with you. We have links to the event, Promising Pathways, on our webpage at wgcunews.org, so anyone interested can click on the Gulf Coast Live tab there and find this segment and find more information. I'd like to thank all of our guests for coming on the show today. Leanna Nowak from FGCU Center for Autism. Also thanks to Brad Karpel, our FGCU student and past speaker at Promising Pathways, and also his uncle, Stan. Thank you so much for coming in. Coming up, the Echo Global Farm is doing its part to try to curb world hunger by developing sustainable agricultural practices in seven different climates right here in Southwest Florida. We'll find out how they do it after this quick break.